This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a nonprofit whose goal is to help seniors stay in their own homes.
We have several members and volunteers that have formed a bond, and they continue to do the same service for that same member. That's what we want to grow. We want to grow these relationships.
Also, learn about the company behind San Luis Obispo's downtown light displays.
We came up with the concept of these open-air memory moment pods. We designed different experiences that people could walk through with sound and light.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 11th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. More than 200 workers at Alphabet, the parent company of Google, have announced they're forming a union with the Communications Workers of America. In the past, service workers at companies like Apple and Facebook have joined traditional unions, but the Alphabet union is a first of its kind in Silicon Valley. KQED's Sam Harnett reports.
Alexander Peterson remembers how he felt the day he got the software engineering job at Google in 2016.
When I joined, I was thrilled. It was this magical place where everybody works together.
He totally nerded out on Google.
We build a planet scale computer. We own our own oceanic cable.
Over the last 4 years, Peterson has gotten increasingly disenchanted. He participated in the Google walkout in 2018, when 20,000 workers protested sexual harassment, a lack of diversity, and the second-class status of temps and contractors, which account for over half the company's workers. He also supported workers fighting against Google's contracts with the military. And now, he is one of the organizers of this new union.
We really want to save Alphabet from itself, stop it from becoming just another one of these huge, inhuman, faceless entities that just bulldozes humanity for the sake of profit.
But their group is small, 225 people at a company with over 260,000 workers. And this union includes a wide variety of people, everyone from cafeteria workers to programmers. It's not yet recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. In a statement, Google didn't recognize the union either and said, quote, "We'll continue engaging directly with all our employees."
There are a lot of barriers to building solidarity within Google.
Chris Tilley is a professor of urban planning at UCLA. He says because Google has been so effective at fissuring its workers, making some contractors, others temps, and outsourcing work around the globe, it's very hard for workers to organize.
It also just creates all kinds of divisions among workers. And it potentially means that sort of different groups of workers can be pitted against each other.
There has long been an anti-union streak in Silicon Valley. Robert Noyce, who co-founded Intel in 1968, is quoted saying, "If we had the work rules that unionized companies have, we'd all go out of business." Today, Michael Solana, a venture capitalist at the Founders Fund, is one of many critics. He wrote on Twitter that the Alphabet Union is, quote, "appropriating the language of exploited coal miners." There's also been criticism of how varied the grievances are of union members, which range from the treatment of contractors to Google's product decisions and lack of diversity. But labor lawyer Caitlin Vega says what Alphabet workers want is actually not that different from what workers want in any union.
Every union is about worker power and workers getting a say in what happens on the job. And I think even when you read back to some of the earliest unions, you know, the unions of teenage girls who were working in garment shops, their demands were not always simple.
The laws that govern unions in the U.S. make it really hard for workers at Google to form a traditional union. Contractors, which make up a large part of the company, are technically barred from joining unions. And legal precedent makes it difficult for unions without a majority of workers to bargain for contracts.
That was KQED's Sam Harnett reporting. Pacific Grove is sometimes called Butterfly Town, USA. That's because thousands of Western monarch butterflies usually spend the winter there. But this winter, its monarch sanctuary is empty. As KAZU's Erica Mahoney reports, monarchs across the Central Coast and North America are disappearing, and federal protection is years off.
On a chilly December morning, Bree Machuca walks into the entrance of Pacific Grove's Monarch Butterfly Sanctuary. Eucalyptus leaves crunch beneath her feet. Binoculars in hand, she's searching for the orange and black symbol of Pacific Grove.
We do counts, usually at 7:15 in the morning.
Machuca is the community science specialist for the Pacific Grove Museum of Natural History. Eucalyptus, Monterey pines, and cypress trees tower over a meandering dirt path. Not long ago, monarchs would have covered almost every branch. Today,
we can't find anything. It's very disappointing because I was expecting at least we'd see maybe a few hundred. I'd see one or two.
Back in 1997, 45,000 monarchs showed up to the sanctuary. This spot was one of 400 overwintering sites along the Pacific coast. Now, 3/4 of the sites are empty. Monarchs migrate thousands of miles to spend the winter in these Goldilocks environments like the sanctuary. They are not too hot, not too cold, and they offer protection from the wind.
I've gone to 23 sites so far this year. I've seen 15 monarchs.
Connie Masati has been counting Western monarchs for almost 10 years. For the past two, she's served as the regional coordinator for the counts in Monterey County.
I've actually sat in the parking lot the first couple of times and actually cried in my car because I've seen it coming, but I did not think I would not be able to find one monarch.
Pacific Grove has embraced its connection with the butterflies. In October, a parade celebrates the return of these creatures. It's been an annual tradition since 1939. In front of the Pacific Grove post office, a statue of children dressed in monarch costumes greets customers. The butterfly is even on the city's official logo. The decline of monarchs has been gradual, but accelerated in the last few years.
I think that was a wake-up call to a lot of people and agencies that we had taken the monarch for granted that it would always be here because they were so prolific.
One of the biggest threats to the population is the development of overwintering sites for housing or golf courses. Habitat loss from climate change is another big factor. Even small changes can have big consequences.
It doesn't take but one of these big branches to go away, and it changes the wind in this sanctuary.
Pesticides are also a big problem, and wildfire can destroy overwintering sites. But protecting monarchs is proving difficult. A California court recently decided insects, including butterflies, do not fall under the California Endangered Species Act. And last month, U.S. Fish and Wildlife said monarchs deserve federal protection, but declined to list them as endangered. That's because an overwhelming number of species are already waiting. So for now, it's up to people, nonprofits, and communities to help. Pacific Grove takes monarch protection seriously. Caleb Schneider manages the city's sanctuary. He says people have been calling him concerned about the butterflies.
It's just, you know, devastating to them for their identity and, you know, their connection to their community.
Still, Schneider has hope. Last year, he and volunteers planted 70 new trees in the sanctuary.
We thought otters were extinct for quite some time, and then they found a little group of them in the Big Sur. So there's always hope. It's amazing what nature's able to accomplish. We just have to provide nature the space to do it.
And you can help, too. If you live on the coast, plant native nectar-rich plants like manzanita or black sage, food that monarchs rely on during their stay.
That was KAZU's Erica Mahoney reporting in Monterey County. Santa Barbara filmmaker Heather Hudson recently released her third film, a tribute to surf pioneer Marge Calhoun. KCBX talked with Hudson about her projects and the desire to document the role of women in surfing.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Santa Barbara filmmaker Heather Hudson. I met Heather many years ago. We dropped our kids off in the same elementary school car line, and she always had a surfboard with her. That was before she started making films. Hi, Heather. Thank you for talking with me today.
Hi, Beth.
Before we hear about your new film, can you talk a little about how you got into surfing and what the sport means to you personally?
Well, I got into surfing back in the late 70s. Our family moved out to Malibu Canyon from LA, and the world opened up to me. I was about 15 and thought I could do that. I remember watching the guys surfing, and a lot of the girls, we were on the beach, you know, went down with our boyfriends. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm going out there. It's the beauty of it, the light, the feeling. And I wasn't going to let anything stop me from being there. So,
and the filmmaking aspect of it is a fairly recent passion. How did you get involved in that?
I was featured in a film way back in 2006 at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. I was one of a handful of surfers that were included in a film called The Craving. And a friend of mine, Peck Ewer, he was the filmmaker and asked me if I would participate. And this is before everything was going digital. It was kind of in that little transformation of digital cameras and everything. When I saw the film, I thought, oh my gosh, I want to tell stories about women. Because women have always surfed. We've always been there. And Peck was my, you know, just that spark. And I asked him, I said, hey, I want to make a film about women. I knew nothing about making films.
Your first two films were called Women in the Waves, one and two. And what was the response from women surfers about those films?
The Women in the Waves came out in 2009. And I was really noticing, just my friends and I were noticing all the women that were coming out. I mean, after early 2000s, there was just a tidal wave of women starting to surf. So I just thought it'd be neat to be able to tell those stories of what it's been like to be a woman in a positive light. And the women and men, I had a lot of men who have mothers and daughters, and they would thank me for making these films. I just love to tell stories from the feminine perspective and stay positive.
Your new film is called 93 Letters from Marge.
Yes.
It was just released in 2020, and it's a tribute to Marge Calhoun, who was a pioneer in the surfing world. Can you tell us about Marge?
Yes. Marge Calhoun was a role model to me. When I started surfing in the late 70s, you know, there weren't a lot of women to look up to, and mostly we saw them in magazines or heard about them. There were communities of women in, you know, at every beach, there's women that have always surfed, but she was someone that I knew about. And wow, what an amazing, amazing surfer and a pioneer, just in that she went out there and she charged. Back in the day, she was the 1958 Makaha International Champion. I did include her in my first film to some degree. She was about 85, I believe, when I first did that film. And I wanted an older woman to be in this film. I wanted to include all ages. She wouldn't go on camera. She was very private, lived in Morro Bay at the time, but I did include her. She loved my film. And I got this handwritten, 2 or 3 page handwritten letter, and her handwriting is beautiful. And it just reminded me of my grandmother. So I wrote her back, and we just kept going back and forth. And there's something about handwriting and handwritten letters that just have so much meaning. And I sent her one letter that I had typed on a computer just because I had to say so much. And I never did it again because she hated the computer. She only had a phone, a dial-up phone at her house.
Really?
And no computer. Yeah, no computer, nothing. And she was old school. And I think we need to remember how to be that way, because there's just a lot of soul in that, I think. She passed away in 2017 in September. I wanted to do it started out as a 5-minute tribute, and I realized, oh, this is getting more involved.
And you tell the story using letters that she wrote to you, and it's told from her perspective.
It is. And I wanted to respect her in that she was a very private person. She also wrote letters to other friends. And during this process, it took me 2.5 years to make the film, and it started growing as it went along. And I had some letters, but some of the letters didn't have more details. So I was able to connect with a few others of her friends, and they shared their letters with me as well. So when I wrote the narration, I was able to fill in the blanks with some of the comments she would make about being in Hawaii, or Moving up to Mavericks in the 90s, seeing that wave go off. I mean, there were so many great stories that she told. And one of the big things that I took away from her letters and why this film was made is her positive attitude as she aged. And I just thought, wow, if I could keep a positive attitude like her till the end of my life, I wanted to share that with other people just as an inspiration.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Santa Barbara filmmaker Heather Hudson. The movie really gets at her connection and love for the ocean. It's even as an older woman in her later years, when she wasn't out surfing or at the beach, but she was watching the waves from her window.
I think anyone that's a surfer and a lifelong surfer feels the same way about the ocean and just being out there in nature and in beauty. And, you know, you're touched by it. And that's the draw, I think. And as the decades have gone on, as many know, surfing has exploded in popularity. And back when I was starting to surf, we were basically considered bums. And I didn't tell people I surfed back when I was in college because they just thought you didn't do anything, you know, or that you were lazy or something. But as time went on, now it's flipped upside down. Everybody surfs and everybody wants that peace and that joy that you can find in the water. And Marge was able to express that in her letters. I hoped in my film that people would take away that joy that she received from the ocean.
You mentioned earlier that women have always surfed. Women are not new to surfing, but it's new to be included in the stories of surfing.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, now, I mean, it's been a good few decades. Women are really included. And there is so much content out there now. I love that women are more included now more than ever. A lot of younger people I've talked to, they don't know that women really weren't welcome back when we started. And, you know, back when I started, it was sort of like, oh, who are you? Why are you here? And now it's just more inclusive, I think.
Is it part of your goal to create historical documents?
As time goes on and the responses that I've gotten from the films that I've made, I want to share the stories of women. There weren't a lot of cameras around. A lot of surfers just did their own thing. And to be able to document that and say, hey, here's these women over here that really didn't get a lot of attention. Marge actually did, her daughters. They were in the magazines and things. But, you know, in a male-dominated sport, women were sort of overlooked all through the decades. So I've just found it, I really want to share stories about the women that came before, because I think it's really important, man or woman, to look back and see where we've been and how those people paved the way for us to be where we are. And I guess I'm talking more in general too.
Yeah.
But with surfing, I just think it's really important to look back and know that women were there all along.
And is there equal representation now with media coverage and opportunities for competition?
Well, I'm just an observer. I never competed, but I honestly look at what's happening now and it is nice. It does seem like they're a lot more inclusive. And that's a big step. And I think the women are getting a lot of respect now that they didn't receive in years past.
And prize money and sponsorships.
Oh, yeah, they have equal pay now. Yeah, yeah. That's pretty crazy that they get equal pay. What a nice example to set.
I watched 93 Letters from Marge on the Surf Network. And,
oh, cool. Great.
Yeah, it's in the category under women's surfing. So there were several films there, three of which were yours.
Yes.
But it seems like there's plenty of room for more. Do you have plans? What's next for you?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. For me, making films is a really, it takes up so much time, energy, money. But I do it because I want to tell the stories. And it's a side gig for me. It takes a lot. I have to feel passionate about it. And Marge did that for me. I thought, oh no, uh-oh, I got to make a film about Marge.
Mm-hmm.
But the super cool thing is I got to connect with her friends and I got to connect with her daughter, Robin Calhoun, who also lives in Morro Bay and, you know, loved her mother dearly and was really, really helpful in making this film by sharing images from their photo albums. And
the voice is one of Marge's friends, right?
It is. Yes, yes. Terry Esselin, she is a friend of Marge Calhoun's. I asked her if she would read the narration. So we went to a studio, and man, we were there for hours and she read all those letters. And I think she did a great job. One thing that's really fun is after I make the films, the responses are so wonderful that it makes me want to make something else, but I'll have to wait and see. I don't have an agenda. I'm making these stories so people can appreciate life. It's more about life and positivity.
You've been featured at several film festivals around the country.
Yes.
So maybe when that kicks back in, you'll have more of an opportunity to show your films.
Well, I love doing film festivals. That's such a great way to get the films out there for people to see. And unfortunately, COVID had different ideas, but we were opening film at Surf Night at the Fremont last March, and it got canceled a week ahead. We'll look forward to something else in the future. But we also got into San Diego Surf Film Festival. That was postponed. Honolulu Surf Film Festival. And we did that one in July. And we won audience choice, audience favorite. So that gave me a little more momentum.
2021 will present more opportunities, hopefully.
I hope so. I kind of figured out a way of sharing my films. I love to do events and I do fundraising. I work with Heal the Ocean here in Santa Barbara, and I just feel it's so important to give back to the community as well.
That was Santa Barbara filmmaker Heather Hudson. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Many seniors today would prefer to age in their own homes, but some don't have access to the help they need to make it possible. On today's nonprofit story, we'll learn about a local organization's goal of keeping seniors in their homes and at the same time creating a community.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and today with me I have Carrie Sheets, who is the Executive Director of Slow Village. What is Slow Village? And in particular, how are you different than some of the other villages that we hear about in our county?
Slow Village is a vibrant community working together to create a better experience of aging. So our members and our volunteers both enjoy social events and activities, educational opportunities, and just the opportunity to make new friends. Another thing is it gives a sense of great purpose or meaning to not only volunteers that maybe are retired from their careers and looking for something more to give back, but also our members perform reciprocal activities, and that gives them a sense of purpose as well. That's who we are. And we often can be confused with the villages, which is a retirement community where you live. Our focus is to enable older adults to remain in their own homes as they age so that they don't have to move into an assisted living situation or even move out of state or out of their community to live nearer their children.
So you are actually, though, a community. Is that correct? Are you bounded in a certain area?
Yes. We like to say we're a community because it's the give and take of everybody in our community, mm-hmm. and our members and volunteers. And our volunteers are highly vetted. We do background checks, interviews with them, and they select the kinds of things that they're interested in. So we even like to pull from our volunteer pool to give presentations to our community.
So just to be clear then, are you located in a certain area? Like, are you in San Luis Obispo or Arroyo Grande, or where are you actually located?
We are actually countywide now. Oh. We have members and volunteers all the way down in Napomo and up to Paso Robles and out to Morro Bay and Pismo and Oceano.
Yeah, how does that work? I mean, if I wanted to become a member of Slow Village, how would I be able to do that?
The easiest way is to call our office or go to our website, which is slowvillage.org. Mm-hmm. And on our website, there is a membership application you can fill out, and you will immediately be called back, and we will learn more about you, find out what your needs are, what you're looking for, and do an interview with you. We're doing those over the phone, of course, mostly now, and just kind of get to see how we can best meet your needs.
So that means what you're doing is letting me become a part of the membership community. I get the services, but I can live where I want to live. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yes, we have no place. We don't even really have an office right now since COVID, but we're all about enabling older adults to remain in their homes because, you know, over 80% of people over 60 say they plan to stay in their own home till they die. But a way lower percentage of those people are actually able to do that. And a lot of my passion about this organization is seeing my own parents as they aged and they were hiring people to take their garbage cans out to the curb, you know, things that your neighbors could do. Well, we live in a much more independent society. So in a sense, you know, when we say we're reinventing aging, in a way, we're recreating the neighborhood idea that we all experienced generations ago or heard about generations ago.
So tell me about how being a member makes a difference. What about the member fees? Is there an annual fee? And what do you get for the membership?
It's an annual fee. For a single person, it's $500 a year. For a couple or more than two or more people in a household, it's $750 a year. We also have a social membership, and that's for people who, I think it's for people who would like to just try out our program, see what it's about. And also they have, the social members have access to all our activities. We also keep a vetted vendor list, which they have access to. As a full member, you have access to all of that and services. Services which include transportation, and we are not like Uber. We are door-to-door service. So, you know, we either wait for you at your appointment or we come back at the appointed time, but we don't, you know, drop you off and, you know, push you out the door. So we help you if you need help into the car, that kind of thing. A big request during the COVID time has been for assistance with technology. We've really been trying to help more of our members be able to use Zoom or FaceTime with their families, things like that. But Zoom, especially to join our activities, which we've had to all move all to online. We still do in-home services, you know, very protected and carefully. Another thing, important thing is just yard work. You know, that becomes really overwhelming as you get older. So as long as it's not like you're asking to have your whole yard re-landscaped, we have people to come and help with your yard work, getting your trash cans to the curb. We do friendly visits. We really ramped up phone calling after the pandemic broke out. So we really see that one thing that happens as many people age is their world kind of closes in on them, which happened exponentially after COVID broke out here. So one of my biggest goals is to keep our members and our volunteers actually connected with each other, with somebody somehow. So phone calls, we do porch visits. We're hoping to start a pen pal program very soon. But meanwhile, we've still been having people send cards, just keep in touch with, you know, both members and volunteers, because actually we had a lot of volunteers have to go inactive because of their age and where they felt their risk was.
This sounds so exciting and so many services that are available. We really want to get into a little bit more detail on this. But if you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I am Consuelo Mukes, and my guest today is Carrie Sheets, the Executive Director of Slow Village. So, Carrie, that's really interesting about this fee. You'll pay a one-time fee for the year, and you have a whole list of services that are available, such as your in-home services, your yard work, and I guess you have assistance with animals and other social things that are happening also. So, how does this actually happen? Do you assign particular volunteers to a home?
No, actually what we do is we use a computer data system that was built by one of our board members. And the member just has to call our office and state their request. And it gets posted in a what we call a portal. And our volunteers can check that portal at any point in time and see what's available and choose based on what they want to do, the day of the week, the time, what they can do. And we also send out messages when something isn't being picked up right away.
Mm-hmm. So can you form a relationship with a volunteer? For instance, if you're in a city and there's some regular needs that you have, such as getting your yard clean or the in-home services, can you have that relationship with that volunteer that you can count on?
Absolutely. We ask that the members still always go through the office when requesting services, but we do find that we have several members and volunteers that have formed a bond, and they continue to do the same service for that same member. And that's what we want to grow. We want to grow these relationships. So that's absolutely encouraged.
How many members do you have?
We have 64 members. And we have 49 volunteers. So actually, when people ask us how large our village is, we will say, we have over 100 people because, we're all together.
That sounds together. Good.
Yeah.
Yes. So you're like a family, a village family here. And so this is an everyday thing. You have services that are happening. Is this unique in our area, or are there other areas that are villages like this that are coming up?
There are many other villages. We are part of what's called the Village Movement California. We are one of the founding members of that. There are over 50 villages across California. The Village to Village Network is a nationwide network, and there are over 300 villages across the United States. There are also, at my last count, 5 internationally.
Wow.
So it's a growing movement coming out of a need. Older people living on their own gets really hard, difficult. They need some help, but also the cost of other options is really high.
Yes.
And, if you look at the impact of that on a state like California, it could be tremendous if everybody spent down their assets and moved into assisted living, and the state took care of them. So,
right. And plus, that takes away your freedom and your independence. And it sounds
absolutely.
Like you can stay independent this way. Is there an age requirement to be a member?
We say 60 and above. There's been a couple times where we've had a member a little bit less than that, more because of other, issues that they had that they needed some help with, some disabilities and things like that, but 16 above. Mm-hmm. And I do want to say that we also, we realize that the membership fees are not affordable for everybody, but we really want this to be available to anybody who wants to remain independent, who wants to continue to make some new friends and learn new things. So we do write grants, and we have donors. So that enables us to be able to subsidize memberships.
So you do need community support with donors, and you are a 501c3 nonprofit.
We are.
Okay. Now, if people would like to be able to support Slow Village, I'm sure they could go to your website and find out more about that.
Yes.
So I know at one point we were talking, and you said that you feel like you are an intergenerational community.
Our volunteers tend to be younger, older adults, but we've been working with Cal Poly, actually. We did a project with them for one of their business classes, and they wound up interviewing our members and some of our volunteers to produce messaging so that we could reach out to different audiences when we're trying to let people know about us, because we need to talk to adult children of older adults. We need to talk to younger people who might be interested in helping our members with technology. But we want to build this intergenerational community because each generation has so much to offer each other. We're hoping to get into some storytelling things, and we're just looking forward to a lot of more options that we may be doing with Cal Poly.
I wonder, now that you have more people on Zoom, are you able to do more group-oriented things so people aren't lonely during the day?
Well, that goes two ways. Unfortunately, a lot of older adults are still reluctant to take on computer technology. But those who have, which is interesting, some of our oldest members are on our weekly coffee chat, which is Zoom, our every other week movie groups, and we have a every other week happy hour. So we're trying to expand that technology usage among our members. But for those who don't use technology, we're using the telephone to call. We're trying to make visits, even though we're out in the doorway, or we, in the summer, we would meet them out in the porch, 6 feet apart with masks on. You know, that's how we used to communicate, right?
Right. This is sounding like such a great program. I want to know a little bit more about your vetted vendors. It sounds like you have a whole list of services. So what are vetted vendors, and how can we feel like we can be safe if we have one of your vetted vendors?
Well, some of our vetted vendors, we get their license numbers if they're licensed professionals, but we also use organizations that members have used and highly recommend. You know, like construction, plumbers, home care and health services, financial help, electricians. And a lot of this is for when our volunteers can't do the handyman jobs. They're too complicated. Then, you know, we need to refer them to a professional organization.
You know, and on your volunteers, let's say somebody was interested in volunteering with you. What's the process?
They can go to our website and fill out an application or call the office. But once we get an application from them, we touch base with them and let them know that they will get an email from a background check company that they will provide their information to. So they don't have to give us their information. It stays confidential with that company. Then we do a reference check on them. We do an interview, and then we have a training for them. And part of the training is to go through things like protocols with transportation, things they'll may need to expect with members. The other part is the technical part of how to go onto our website, to the volunteer portal, to see how to check what requests are there.
So are you in need of any volunteers at this time?
We are always in need of them. We lost quite a few volunteers to, you know, needing to go inactive to stay safe during COVID. So we would love volunteers. We especially need volunteers who are comfortable driving. And we have a protocol for driving. So, you know, the driver wipes down his car, wears a mask. The passenger sits in the back seat with a mask on, windows down if possible. But, you know, people need to get to important doctor's appointments and things like that still. So,
Carrie, tell us again how to get in touch with you through your website.
It's slowvillage.org.
This has been The Nonprofit Story. I am Consuelo Mewks, and today I had the wonderful time of talking with Carrie Sheets, who is the executive director of Slow Village. And I hope you will go to their website and learn more about it. Carrie, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today on The Nonprofit Story.
Thank you so much.
Downtown San Luis Obispo's streets are draped with lights, and Mission Plaza was the site of socially distanced holiday activities. We learn more about the festivities and what effect it's had on the downtown core, according to Downtown Slow.
This is Bettina Swigger for Issues and Ideas with our monthly segment called Around Downtown. And just a note for the listeners, in addition to being your KCBX radio correspondent, I am also the CEO of Downtown Slow. I am having a conversation today with two business people who run an events company called Carson Butler Events, which is located bi-coastally They have a program here in San Luis Obispo and also in Washington, D.C. They are sisters. They are twin sisters, and their voices sound very similar. So I have Emily and Amber. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, I'm Amber Carson, and I'm Emily Butler, and we are a bi-coastal luxury event planning firm with offices in Washington, D.C. and California. We started the company in 2008 in Washington, D.C. So I've been an event planner for 20 years and had an amazing career in corporate America, planning events around the globe in the investment industry, and then decided to take that entrepreneurial dream and bring it to life and started Carson Butler Events there in D.C. in 2008. The business was starting to grow. I needed another full-time pair of hands working. And who better than my own twin sister, Emily? So I worked in the auto industry for over a decade before joining Amber on the East Coast. So I worked for Toyota and Lexus for over 10 years and made the leap of faith. I joined Amber on the East Coast, and it's been a very fun, wild journey ever since. Yeah, so then basically we're both in DC growing the business and had always had a plan to kind of reopen and be bi-coastal and have East Coast, West Coast. So we're born and raised Californians. I always wanted to come back here. And so we came back and opened our West Coast office in San Luis Obispo back in 2014. So then I moved back to California and Emily is still in Washington, D.C. So we've kind of flip-flopped places, which is a little bit ironic. It works because I love San Luis Obispo. I can't even imagine living anywhere else now. And I love to come visit. But I'm a city girl at heart, so it works.
I'm excited to talk to you both today because we had the opportunity at Downtown SLO to work with you on this wonderful program during the holiday season called Light Up Downtown. And we'll talk about that more in a minute. But recently you opened a retail store as well.
So we opened Carson Butler at the historic All Louis store in 2016, so 4 years ago on Small Business Saturday. And I always loved that building on the corner of Toro and Palm. It wasn't available when I was looking for office space, but I would talk to people at cocktail parties and tell people about my dream building. I'm a big believer in saying your dreams out loud. And so one day, a couple years later, I received a text message from a friend's wife that said, I think you mentioned the All Louis store was your dream building and there's a four lease sign in the window. And for those of you who have lived in SLO for a while, you know that it was empty for a long time, but the lease was tied up. And so I jumped down and found out who the agent was, and we were selected to take the lease over and didn't really have any big plans to open a retail part of our business at the time, but the building is zoned retail, so I couldn't use it just as Carson Butler office space. And so I called Emily, said, my dream building's available. What do you think about opening a retail store? This is Emily. I never forgot getting that call and that conversation. And we've always loved beautiful gifting items for our planning clients. We love paper, greeting cards, stationery, gifting. And so while it seems crazy now, we took a leap of faith as we've done a few times in our business. And we are so excited that we just celebrated our 4-year anniversary at such a historic building.
That's great. And have you made any steps to bring that retail experience into the online space?
We have. It's, you know, we had a small online presence, but COVID really made that a necessity. So we had to shift platforms, completely invest in new software to really make sure that we could reach our audience with the doors, you know, physically shut. We couldn't rely on just the passerby traffic and the tourists coming to downtown SLO. And so our reach for Carson Butler really is more of a national reach anyway. And so we had this opportunity to try to market to some people that might not physically be able to come to San Luis Obispo. So that definitely was one of the silver linings, I think, was the necessity to really shift and put some energy and love into an online store, which we hadn't really done before.
Yeah, and with a small business, it is a little unique than other online outlets. We don't have a huge warehouse of inventory. So your online inventory system really needs to talk real time. So when we were able to reopen safely at a modified extent, our inventory also needed to then talk to each other. So definitely had to kind of make the investment early on when the shutdown started, provide a safer alternative to shopping for those locally that want to continue to support and shop local from the comfort of their homes.
So has the retail been in some ways a buffer from the catastrophic effect that COVID has had on the events industry?
Yeah, I mean, in all transparency, the event side of our business is definitely what typically carries the retail passion project, if you will, as a new retail. Retail in general is hard, but the new retail takes years to really for that investment to pay off. And so it's been interesting to be able to now have at least an outlet to have some sort of income coming in. Events, as you know, in California are completely not happening for the foreseeable future. It'll be likely a year before events that are really able to happen again. And that's devastating to a business. So we feel very fortunate that we have eggs in different baskets, if you will, in terms of being able to pivot and really kind of change some of our priorities in what we're working on day to day to be able to really focus on the store. And it's been, I think, more than financially for us, the heart of the store is general store for celebrations, big and small. And the whole purpose is to help spread joy, whether that's somebody's birthday or just a coworker that needs a pick me up, or, you know, a more significant celebration, like a life milestone, like a wedding or an anniversary.
I love what you just said about it being a general store for celebrations, big and small. In some ways that feels like a little bit of a symbol for what a downtown can be as well, right? It's this concentrated area where we get to have these celebrations, whether it's a concert or a graduation or a birthday party or just a special dinner or night out with friends. Where did you come up with that language?
Gosh, well, when we took over the All Louis store, we really wanted to honor the history of All Louis himself and its prominence in our community for so many years. You know, our historic building, you know, there in Chinatown of downtown SLO, it was like this amazing place where people would gather. And so we wanted to kind of honor that style of a store, a general store where you can come and get to see your neighbors, talk about the week, and just honoring that legacy in our way too. So we focus on events and everyday events as well should be celebrated. So whether you're coming in just to honor the history of the building or to say hi to your fellow retailer down the street. We love that spirit and we love that. We wanted to make sure that when we started the store, focused on what is our mission? What do we want the store to be? So even if you never buy anything from us, if you walk in, we want you to feel that joy. We want you to feel that welcome spirit. And I think that's true for all of downtown.
Definitely. And the location, the physical location of the building is kind of at a gateway point into the downtown. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the program for Light Up Downtown, which is entering a new phase right now. And that's been such a joy to collaborate with you on. How did that come about? And what can we expect to see going forward in January and February for the Light Up Downtown program in downtown San Luis Obispo?
Yes. Well, we're really excited to be able to partner with the city of San Luis Obispo and the Downtown SLO Association on the Light Up Downtown effort. We received an RFP that we applied for and we were selected to be a strategic partner to help bring their vision to life. And the RFP, I think, said, you know, how can we create safe experience throughout the entire month of December? And so we came up with the concept of these open air memory moment pods. We designed different experiences that people could walk through with sound and light and really create this immersive experience for everyone to enjoy at their own time, like what they feel safe in their own immediate households. I think one of the key elements was having it not just one night, but the entire month. And you'll see we have some fun new ideas to continue the spirit of coming downtown safely with your household, supporting downtown local businesses, grabbing that takeout and strolling the lights on your way home. So for the holiday season, it was wonderful. And then we've switched out some of the decor for New Year's to celebrate 2021 and say goodbye to 2020. We have some fun plans to help celebrate Lunar New Year and also Valentine's Day. So everyone can get excited about hopefully coming back downtown if you haven't recently please, please do so. Our local retail needs you to come shop. January is definitely a tough month for retail. So if you have the means to come and shop local still in January, it's important and help support our restaurant and dining outlets in downtown as well. It's restaurant month. So you can get some good deals.
That's right. Yeah, you can get your takeout. You can order your takeout from a restaurant, wander through Mission Plaza, see the disco balls. How many disco balls are in the New Year's Eve pod?
Oh my goodness. I think we have 10.
10 disco balls. Yeah, it's a party. It's really cool. I mean, fun. A safe party, but still a festive sight to see.
I love Instagram and all the Instagrammable moments. So if you see me doing a selfie with the disco balls. That's never cool. Enough sparkle here, Carson Butler event. More is more is one of our mottos.
Excellent. I love it. I love it. Well, one of the exciting collaborations that came out of the Light Up Downtown program was the installation of the zigzag bistro lights across the streets. And I call it a collaboration because you were working with installers to put those lights up, but it actually involved bringing in property owners and the city. And I believe that's going to continue and be part there. The city is now looking at ways to make that a permanent installation. So it's really cool to see how something that we might have thought of being a one-time substitution for something could generate more of a permanent effect, not just during the holiday season, but year round.
Yeah, it was incredible to hear from our fellow business owners downtown about how special that made downtown feel and how, you know, because of public interest to keep it up, that the city's able to do so. So that's really, really exciting. And we've heard from so many customers that would come in and just say, gosh, it's never looked better. And just thanks for bringing the spirit back to downtown. So we were honored to be a strategic partner and help bring joy.
I mean, we've been reliant in our downtown on events to create the space in a lot of ways, right? We have our Thursday night farmers market. We have our beloved concerts in the plaza season. And then, of course, there are tons of nonprofit groups that put on other concerts and plays and festivals and fairs and those sorts of things. How do you see the event industry making space for people to gather over the next year as we start to emerge from COVID and people become vaccinated?
Well, I definitely think events are going to look different, you know, forever. I think there are definitely some lessons that were learned in the last year that I think there's best practices that we'll continue to see in events. So things are never going to go back to probably entirely the way they were, you know, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think we're going to see events roll out, you know, in terms of the size and the number of people that are allowed at gatherings. I think that's worked successfully in other states to be able to have kind of a tiered approach to reopening. So we are hopeful in the year ahead that events will come back and, you know, they probably will come back in terms of the number of people we're allowed to gather in different stages, depending on.
Yeah, and in DC, we've always had kind of additional security measures and different protocols and requirements. And I think just having a layer of safety and health integrated into your planning plans will be something that is continued from a crowd control, from a how you're serving food and beverage,
sanitation requirements. Budgets look a little bit differently. People are going to need to make sure that they're budgeting time and resources and staffing to be able to tackle some of these issues that this pandemic has brought to light.
Virtual events and hybrid events we will continue to see even as the world reopens, even in a tiered approach, there's going to be a lot more need for a hybrid type of strategy. So technology budgets will need to increase when we're thinking of events. So when we can gather, some people might choose not to, or some companies might choose to send only a handful of people. So having the technology in place to maybe stream your event so that people can still participate, I think that will be something that we will see as well.
I mean, in California, obviously, we have good weather, which is a huge bonus, especially as we're in January. We've always had wonderful venues for outdoor events in San Luis Obispo. Do you see more outdoor events probably happening in DC?
Absolutely. So the weather is always something that anyone that's not in California is jealous of. definitely kind of having outdoor, we're seeing a trend for, you know, on the social side, instead of looking at ballrooms, looking at more rooftops and maybe, you know, thinking about hosting an event at home with a tent and air circulation versus all indoor. You definitely will see that trend weather dependent. When things start opening up, people are going to probably keep it local. So instead of maybe companies going overseas for their incentive travel program, they might be looking to stay domestically within the United States. California companies might not be looking to cross state lines, and they may be looking for a host for their executive board retreat. And San Luis Obispo offers amazing opportunities to have these experiences. It's one of the reasons why when we chose where to open in California, we picked San Luis Obispo because of the potential that we see here for the types of programs that we hope come. Now, this COVID thing has been definitely, you know, a big roadblock for the short game, but I still feel very, very confident about San Luis Obispo's strategic position to be a really amazing destination for a lot more business in the future.
Totally agree. And even some of the structural changes and architectural changes that have come out over the last 2 or 3 years, we have 2 hotels in the downtown now that have rooftop bars, to your point, Emily, about having rooftops be a great gathering point. I hope we see more of those, right? We see the SLO Museum of Art is currently covering their building with a mural. We have these fantastic blank canvases of the buildings throughout the downtown. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there were more opportunities to be surprised and delighted by the actual architecture of the building and the externality, and not just when you walk inside and are able to step inside and see a space?
Absolutely agree.
So we're wrapping up here. So is there anything else you'd like to add just about what it's like for you to work as a family business?
There's ups and downs of working together as sisters, as I'm sure you can imagine. But overall, we're a really great team. And when Amber thinks of a crazy idea, I'm the one that helps bring it to life, and vice versa.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Issues and Ideas. This is Bettina Swigger. I've been speaking with Amber Carson and Emily Butler from Carson Butler Events. I hope to see you soon around downtown.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.